You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with the Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I've got Danny Johnson. Danny, how you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on, Ken.
Well, thanks for being on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
So Danny is out of San Antonio. He's got a business where he fix and flips. He does some wholesale deals. He does an owner finance. Most of you probably know him from Flipping Junkie. He actually, a couple years ago, did a 34-week blog that chronicled everything he did over that 34-week, every deal that he analyzed and every deal that he bought and sold. Became actually fairly popular. So that website actually turned into an ebook that he sells on Amazon called Flipping Houses Exposed. He's also got some software programs out there. But Danny, I'd love to know, before you got into all this, before you got into real estate and software and writing ebooks, how did you even make that move into real estate?
Yeah, so I was, you know, working as a software developer and working for a defense contractor in San Antonio. And you know, at one point I was working in an office that didn't have windows for a long time. Ooh, and just scary. That artificial light all day. Yeah, no, it was really wearing on me. And I couldn't bear to go in anymore. I had to, though, because I needed, you know, to survive. But actually, at that time, my father had started flipping houses. And he was, when I was growing up, he was actually a contractor doing work remodeling houses for a long time. And I'd help him with that stuff. And graduated from college with a computer science degree and started doing software. He started flipping houses, and he was just having a blast. You know, and every time I talked to him, he was just excited. You know, it's like it was crazy. I never seen him that excited about anything. He was just having so much fun, and he was like super busy, but it didn't seem like a lot of work. It was like he wasn't working. He was just having fun. So, I saw that, and he didn't say, hey, why don't you start doing it? You know, I just said, man, that's what I want to do. And so I started educating myself and everything and started part-time. And really, it wasn't something where he told me what to do. Like, you learn this, do this, and do this. You know, he was a mentor, but it was more of like, because he's in a different market.
Okay.
He was in smaller towns, and I'm in San Antonio, which is a pretty big city. So he sort of wanted me to find my way. And then as I came upon like roadblocks or things that I didn't know the answer to, I would call him for advice. So it worked out really well. And I'm glad that, he was there for that support. So, but even though I had him for support, you know, it's like, I remember still the first deal that I ever got. My wife and I went over and we signed a contract and my hand was like so shaky, you know, signing that thing that I think I probably like took up third of the page with my signature all over the text and stuff because it was just so shaky. I was just like, you know, about to have a heart attack. I was so nervous. And, but anyway, we did well, we did that. And we actually spent 2 or 3 years part-time. You know, I had a good paying job and it was kind of hard to leave that security, but we started making so much with the flipping that it just became a no brainer that we needed to do it full-time. And so we went full time after about 2 or 3 years, but we learned, you know, that, you know, the checks sometimes can be few and far between. They're good checks, but, I think having the security of the job is, you know, I just hardly ever recommend for people to like immediately, you know, quit a job to try to do this thing without like having done some deals to see what it's like and
sure,
you know, all that kind of stuff.
But, was that tricky then having this day job and taking phone calls on the side? It's funny because I just interviewed somebody that they were, you know, sneaking into the, like the conference room and taking phone calls.
Yeah.
And,
you know, I had to, you know, I had to go to the stairwell because I wasn't,
that was your spot.
I'm supposed to have a cell phone. So
right.
I would have to make the calls in the stairwell. And then if I heard somebody open a door, you know, a couple flights up where the floor that we were on, I've heard that door open, I had to be real quiet, and I'm sure the sellers were wondering what's going on. He's like, sounds like he's in a pipe or something, you know, like
right,
echoing and stuff. But you do what you got to do, and it actually made it a little bit fun looking back at it, you know, like, you know, taking lunch breaks instead of eating, like hurrying up really fast to check that rehab, make sure the contractor's working and stuff like that.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, when you're used to being an employee and you're getting your W-2 check and they're taking out taxes and they're taking out this and that, it's not, you know, it's usually not a great big check. But then you flip one house and you get like this nice big $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 check. It's just like, holy cow. I just in one fell swoop got this big check and put it in my bank account. I'm sure it starts to become a little bit of addictive.
Yeah, it's great. Right. It's crazy. And, you know, one way I looked at it all the time was, you know, you see those game shows, right? Like $20,000 pyramid or whatever that is. And it's like, you know, these guys have to like get on the show and then make it all the way there. And it's like, we make that on deals all the time. And it's like crazy. You know, it's like we're winning these game shows without having to go through all that work.
Yeah. Your perspective changes so much when you become a real estate investor and you start seeing these big paydays and you remember what your paycheck was like, you know, previously and all the taxes and everything that was taken out of it. It's just, you're like, why in the world am I working this 9 to 5, hitting my head against the wall when I could be out there, you know, making these big checks?
Right, right.
So it took you, what, 2-3 years, and eventually said, okay, forget this. I can do this full time.
Right. Yeah, and then we went full time and just, and you know, but the part-time part of it, you know, I think, you know, people ask all the time, well, do you wish you had went full time earlier? And honestly, I don't know that I would, because it really forces you, you know, to focus on what the best use of your time is. You know, it's like, what is the 20% of things that you can do that's going to produce 80% of the results?
Absolutely.
And you're forced to focus on those things because you just don't have the time to do anything else.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way of looking at it.
Right. And then, you know, you're not going to end up over at the house swinging a hammer because you don't have time to do that. You're going to learn how to hire a contractor that's going to do the job for you and find one that you don't have to manage, you know, all the time. You know, you'll go through contractors and, you know, spend the time you learn to spend the time to find the perfect contractor so that your life is easier. And then when you go full time, you know, honestly, I don't know, like, you know, I felt really weird when I went full time. It's like, I don't know what to do with my time now. I feel like I need to do something all the time. But, you know, when you get, you know, you end up with that long part time that you sort of build up those systems or the, you know, what you end up, your habits, and it just makes you a better investor.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. The fact that you were part-time, you had to figure how to leverage your time as best as possible, what little you could devote to it. Like right. You said, you had to build the right teams, and that's a really interesting way. You were already ready to scale it up, truthfully, probably when you stepped off, because you'd already learned how to leverage your time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's hard because, you know, I felt like, you know, I had to deal with disappointment a little bit, though, because it was like things didn't scale up as quickly. It's like you'd done so well over the first couple of years, like getting your business down to a science, and then like you get those gains initially. It's sort of like when you start working out or something, when you're a newbie and you do really well and your weights that you can lift go up pretty quick, and then after a while, after doing it for a while, you don't get those gains as fast. But yeah,
that makes sense. So let's talk about your business. So what is it, how did your business evolve then over the last several years now that you've been full-time? Did you start as like a flipper or a wholesaler, or what did that look like?
Yeah, we started as retail flipping for the most part, and we would do some deals with another investor where we were doing owner financing for the lesser deals. So, you know, if we market all over San Antonio, obviously you've got a lot of great retail areas where you can fix the house up, sell it retail on a new loan to someone that's going to live in the house. And then you've got the lesser areas that are part of any place that are really mostly rental properties and owner finance type properties. And so when you get those leads, you need to, you know what you're going to do. Like, you know, if we just focused on retail and didn't want the properties, the leads that came in for the ones that weren't able to retail, if we didn't have something to do with those, we'd lose out on a lot of profit. So
sure.
Honestly, I prefer to wholesale them.
Yeah.
And you know, and then you don't have any risk. You know, you move them quick, you get some great money. If it's in a really bad part of town, I don't even want to go to, I'll bird dog those leads.
Yep.
And, you know, I can typically get $2,000 for a bird dog lead.
Is that just you handing it off to another wholesaler, basically? Let them worry about
right.
it?
Right. I just send the lead over to them, say, hey, give them a call.
Yeah.
And they go work the deal. They do everything. All I do is a phone call.
Yeah.
And then if they do something with it, you know, it takes follow-up and checking to make sure they did. But there's no written agreements or anything. I just do it. You know, I send it to people that I trust that I've met over the years that I talk with. And once you do that, you know, because everyone's biggest question when you bird dog or something is, well, how do you make sure that they pay you? And it's like, if you can send good deals to them, you know, they're going to make sure that you're happy. They're not,
absolutely.
You know, you might find one or two that's going to not tell you or something. But, you know, if you build relationships with other investors in your town which you really should do. It's not hard to tell who you should be sending stuff off to. And it's always the person that's buying a lot of stuff. The guys that are hustling.
Yep.
Even in San Antonio, I mean, even now, I mean, we've got so much competition here. But really, you know, I think there's probably just a very small percentage are actual real hustlers that do a lot of deals.
That's right. It's the exact same thing in Atlanta. I'm sure there's a zillion people that would consider themselves, you know, real estate investors, and they're sending out marketing, but there's just a handful of us that are really, really doing deals. And we're always, I mean, it's very incestuous. It's probably the same way in San Antonio. I'm sending them deals. They're selling from me. I'm selling their deals. I'm buying from them. They're buying from me. I mean, it's just like, it's like a trading market. We're constantly trading houses with each other.
Yeah. And so, and the people say, well, how do you find those people? Well, it ends up not being that hard, because after a while you start hearing somebody's name over and over.
Yeah.
Or you're talking to people and you just ask them, who's buying the most? Who do you know is buying the most? And I had just met with a foundation contractor I hadn't used in a while. And I don't know what caused my brain to click over yesterday, but you know, I just stopped and asked, hey, you know, I hadn't seen you in a long time. Who's having you do a lot of foundations, like which means they're buying a lot of deals. And we have a lot of foundation trouble too in San Antonio, but, and I just asked, and there was a name I hadn't heard. So it's like somebody to look up, you know, and someone to make contact with. So
absolutely. Yeah. And people always say, you know, you see the signs up, or you see a bunch of Craigslist ads, or whoever's paying for AdWords. I mean, those are typically the guys that are investing the time and the resources in your market. Get to know them, see what they're doing, and see if you can work with each other.
Yeah. I mean, you might think immediately there's nothing to gain from it,
but
oh, there's so much to gain from it, you know, and it's just cool being able to talk to somebody else that's excited about flipping houses.
You know, especially when you're getting started. I know when I was very first getting started, and I was very green, I went to the big wholesalers in town and asked if I could, you know, sell some of their houses for them. So I went out there and found investors and put my markup on them. I didn't have any skin in the game, which was nice, but I was able to make some money and prove that I could sell some houses. And then all of a sudden, you know, I was playing with the big boys. It was a good stepping stone for me.
That's awesome. It's instant inventory. You know, the hardest part in the beginning is finding deals. So if you just contact other people that have deals already,
that's right.
You just got rid of the hardest part of all of it.
That's right. So you're like a lot of other guys, you're doing the fix and flips, you're doing the wholesale deals, but you're also doing owner finance. I'm curious, what does that model look like for you?
Yeah. And you know, I did more in the past, and really lately it's more of like renting because of the law changes.
Yeah.
Dodd-Frank,
sure.
If you're considering owner financing, make sure you're aware of Dodd-Frank and the implications. I don't want to go into it here. Honestly, it's been a little while since I even, you know, thought about a lot of that, but there are more hoops to jump through with qualifying people, make sure that you're doing things correctly. And the issue really, I guess, boils down to the fact that there's not really any case law.
Yeah.
So if something does happen, somebody sues you for anything, you know, it's kind of hard to say which way things would go. So, you know, honestly, obviously we all do things the right way, but you know, if you get sued, anybody can sue you whether you did something right or wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't want to find yourself on the wrong side of something. So, so honestly, since then, you know, we've said, well, instead of spending the time doing all that stuff, let's rent out. But before, when we were doing the owner finance, it was mainly a sort of thing for long term, because you know, fix and flipping is great, you get the big pays and things, but you want to have something long term that's going to build over time and see that growth, and the interest can be incredible, because when you offer owner financing, obviously you can, you know, ask a higher interest rate for the loan. So you not only sell it for the purchase price, but you get all that interest, which is huge if you amortize over 20 years or more.
And then what sort of underlying financing did you have for most of those? Were you doing like wraparound mortgages?
Right, wraparound mortgages. So we had private lenders we were using, and they were okay with wraparound mortgages. So yep. we were able to get the loan from them for the property, and then we would do a wraparound a mortgage. So we'd do the owner financing to the end buyers that would live in the property.
Yep. That's a great model. You're right, though. Dodd-Frank definitely threw a kink in a lot of people's business models. I actually wrote an article on Bigger Pockets, I don't know, about a year ago. You can Google if you guys are interested, but it sort of laid out, you know, how it really limits guys who are doing the owner financing and, you know, all the different regulations around that. So I can see how that slowed down that business pretty quick.
Yeah, and it's still definitely doable. The cost is greater now because you've got to have different things so in place, and then, you know, just the time involved in having to do those things. So I know people here in town that still do a lot of them, and they just conform to that, and they know that that's just another expense they've got to take care of, and so they are careful when they buy to have that.
Yeah. Well, you're limited too, though, with, I think, the interest rate and on the max amount that you can charge. So You know what? I was curious because I know there's a lot of guys that do the owner finances and let them season for a little bit and then turn around and sell them, you know, on the note market, which has always been something I've been curious in. But it sounds like you're just holding on to these things until they refi.
Well, yeah, and most, you know, we haven't had a whole lot of refis, though. I mean, people are pretty happy with it. They just still, you know, continue to pay. We've had a couple, but, and then we've sold some of them. And it used to be awesome because there was actually a model before everything changed back in 2008. A lot of investors actually were doing owner financing and then selling the note immediately the day they sold the house on owner financing.
Oh, wow. Without even seasoning.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was like they were getting, you know, some people getting like over 90%.
Wow.
And, you know, drive-by appraisals and stuff like that. You know, all that obviously changed in 2008.
Yeah.
But it was you know, man, that was, you couldn't beat that. But yeah, that's all changed.
So let's talk about, you've done some fix and flips. Obviously, that's probably the core of your business, wholesale right. deals, owner finance. Is there one deal in particular that stands out as like your best deal ever?
Yeah, you know, and I was thinking back through, and I've had a couple cases where I've wholesaled and made $50,000 on a wholesale, which
wow.
I'm never, ever going to complain about. I'd like to have more.
Yeah.
One of those did happen while I was doing the 34 weeks of investing that's in the ebook, The Flipping Houses Exposed. That's actually free on Amazon.
Oh,
but
perfect.
Yeah, it's Flipping Houses Exposed on Amazon. But yeah, I think that was the 18th week or something like that during, you know, when I was building my business back up, I was blogging about all the leads that were coming in and the deals that I was doing so that people could see the process of like what a lead looked like, what people told me, you know, because I was doing marketing to motivated sellers. I wasn't focusing on MLS properties.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But basically, the, you know, ended up being a $50,000 wholesale. And honestly, whenever I was making the offer and buying the house, I was actually nervous about the deal.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was like that much better because, you know, I even told my wife and we ended up driving around the neighborhood, you know, the next day going, you know, is this a good buy? Is this a good buy? I couldn't believe, you know, looking back, obviously, it was like funny that I was that concerned. But what ended up happening was a guy had inherited a historic property and I went and looked at it and it had this big addition on the back of it that was not period at all. And it was absolutely disgusting. I thought it was horrible. And, you know, that type of neighborhood was in transition and the values were all over the place.
Yeah.
It was really hard to guesstimate what somebody would put a value like. And so I had to just be conservative. And so that's where my whole debate of is this a decent deal or not. And I think I got it to the point where it was sort of a no-brainer. It's like, you know, I could make a ton, and at the minimum, I'm going to make a little bit. You know what I mean? So
right.
It was, you know, you reduce your risk as much as you can. Obviously, it ended up being the higher side, which is awesome. But, you know, interesting story, though, is the guy, he was out of town, and I looked at it, and then I had gone back and made the offer over the phone, and he accepted over the phone. And typically, you know, if you're new to this, being in person is so much better, you know.
Sure.
Don't get lazy and do it over the phone. But I did it over the phone and you know, he accepted and then I asked, well, when can I meet you to get the contract so we can, you know, get this moving? And he said, well, let me call my attorney and we can meet at his house. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, you know, this, you know, when you get an attorney involved, they want to justify what they're doing. So they find all kinds of things and want to,
oh, yeah,
you know, they could potentially mess up a deal. But you can't say no, you know, you can't tell us, or no, I want, you know, so it's sure. Like, okay, well, fine, find out when we can and we'll meet over there. And then so, and I thought it was weird that he said house too, you know, it's like not his office, but his house, that's kind of weird. So I guess they're buddies or something. And say, okay, we'll find out with him and then, you know, we'll meet. And so he calls me back and he says, yeah, let's meet tomorrow morning. And the house ended up, his attorney's house was, I'm not kidding you, directly across the street from the house I was buying.
Oh my gosh. That's funny.
So I was that much more nervous. I was like, great, now this guy's going to try to get the deal. You know what I mean? Like he's, you know, I didn't know. I had all kinds of like things in my head, like what's going to happen here. So we get over there in the morning. Well, I do by myself and I've got the contract and I sit down at the table with the seller and his attorney. And the attorney has this yellow legal pad. You know, obviously it had to be a legal pad, right?
Right.
But he, you know, and it had all this stuff written on it. And I was like, wow, what is all of this? You know, and so I thought he was going to go in and start picking apart my contract. But he didn't do that. He was asking other questions. And basically what it boiled down to was negotiating.
Huh.
Like the attorney was trying to negotiate, you know, and I had to stop him after like a question or two, and because I saw that's where it was going. And this is where thinking, like being unsure about the deal to begin with, came in handy, because, you know, when you're negotiating, if you're willing to walk away, you're in a much better position.
Absolutely.
And so I was sort of like on the fence, so it made it easier to do this. I'm not going to say I'm like a Superman and this was easy for me to do, but, you know, I looked at the attorney and said, I'm sorry, but we've already discussed price and everything and closing and earnest money and all that kind of stuff. It's already been determined. We're here just to, you know, for you to check the legality of the contract or make sure that you're happy with it. I'm not here to negotiate with you. And he was taken aback. He didn't expect it. You know, he kind of sat back and looked at his client and then looked over at me and said, I'd like to discuss with my client for a minute. I said, sure, take all your time. And went outside and walked around sort of nervously for a couple minutes while they talked. And then he called me back in, you know, and sat down. He said, okay, we're going to sign. Oh, man, that's great. You know, so, you know, I had read a book. If I could remember what the name was, it was something about an intimidation. But it's an awesome book for people maybe that haven't been in negotiating situations or maybe nervous about negotiating with other people. But, you know, it's just realizing that everybody is just a person, like an attorney is just a person. You know, it's not somebody that's like, you know, have these magical powers over you or smarter than you and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's just like going into negotiations, knowing that everybody's just a person, regardless of what their title is or their experience and stuff like that. But
I mean, you weren't afraid to walk away from it. Right, I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah, had I known what I was going to make on it, it might have been a different story.
Well, that's true.
Man, I'm going to lose that on that kind of profit. But so it kind of worked out that way. But anyway, so I bought the house. And with being unsure of what I could sell it for, I wanted to close on it first, especially with, you know, the situation with the seller, you know, being out of town a lot and everything. So I wanted to get it closed, and then I was going to sell it. And the objective was to start at the high end just to see if I could get it, but only have it there for maybe a week and then start coming down on the price. And so, you know, I put it out there, and one of the first investors that I had called was somebody I'd sold a lot of deals to. He went over and looked at it and said he'd take it right away and, you know, at the high price.
Nice.
And so it was just amazing, you know, super exciting. So, yeah, I mean, that's how it worked out. I ended up with $50,000. We actually did take a loan when we bought it just to do some, I think we got $8,000 is what it was, to do some cleanup and a little light remodeling if we needed to.
Yeah.
You know, if we didn't get that price, we need to come down a price. And then, you know, just to be able to do whatever we wanted to do to be able to try to move it. And we didn't end up needing to spend that. And then we got a check for like $42,000 at closing. So that made it over $50,000 for the deal.
Nice. You know, and that's something we've done as well. If it's a deal that I think I can wholesale, but I'm also comfortable rehabbing if I need to and putting it out as a fix and flip, a lot of times we'll just go ahead and buy it rather than try to assign it or double close it. Especially if it's a good deal, you just want to lock it up, get the thing closed, and then figure out what you're going to do with it. It's sort of,
right.
Sort of the same thing.
Yeah, make sure you control it. Yeah, when there's potential to make anything over maybe $15,000,
yeah,
on a wholesale, you definitely want to
just lock it up.
Yeah, find a way. I mean, you're going to spend more having to close it.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, if you can, whenever you wholesale, if you can have them pay closing on the second side, it can help you out. But it's definitely worth it not to stress about losing the deal.
Exactly.
Because so many things could happen between, you know, the closing if you're signing.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't, have you ever personally had, you know, anybody kind of go around you on an assignment or anything?
I've not had anybody go around us, but we've had, we've definitely had sellers back out. You know, it's like the longer you go with a seller, it's like the higher the risk of just losing the deal.
Right.
It's like every day that ticks by, even while we're in due diligence or if we get right up to it, it's just, you know, they freak out, they get other offers. I've had sellers not honor their contract because they got a better offer. It wasn't necessarily that somebody I knew went around me, but they just got a better offer and then voided my contract.
I've had the same thing happen. So I guess that's more of the worry for people. So that's another reason, if you can, to try to close you know, on a lot of the deals, you know, with the bigger spreads on them.
Yeah, if it's a home run, a lot of times just get it, just lock the thing down.
Oh yeah, because you know someone else is going to
exactly
come
right
just offer a little bit more. And,
exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
That's a great story. So, Danny, talk to us about where people can find you. And I know you'd mentioned that you've got some software out there. I think that's worth talking about as well.
Yeah, so I mean, the first place is flippingjunkie.com. It's flipping and then junkie, JUNKIE.com. That's my blog. And so there's the information about the 34 weeks of flipping where I recorded everything and on the blog. And then you can get, it's the same stuff that's on the ebook if you go to Amazon to get the flipping houses exposed. But that's where I post most things about everything that I'm doing with the flipping and everything. And we still are flipping houses while we do software and other things because my background is software. It turns out I still love doing software just for myself, not for as an employee. But the software obviously is for investors because I, you know, once I went into flipping houses, I quickly saw the need to keep track of leads and to be able to schedule follow-up and make sure that everything was sort of kept track of. And it was just for myself at first, but as the years went on, I've sort of evolved it and made it something that other people can use as well. And so you can find that at reimobile.com. So real estate investing, but it's shortened for REI and then mobile.com. And then we also have the, because I get most of my leads from my website. So I have a house buying website. If you want to see that, it's DannyBuysHouses.com. DannyBuysHouses.com. And I sell those templates and everything, the back end says everything that works with that website at LeadPropeller.com. I don't want to go into any sales pitch or anything. Those are just things that I work on that are helpful for me and my business, and a lot of people find helpful in their flipping business.
Absolutely. Well, and especially, there's not many guys that get the majority of their motivated seller leads online. It feels like everybody's doing, you know, signs and postcards and whatever else. So that's very cool that you've perfected that model. And it's, so the Lead Propeller templates are the ones that you're actually using in your business, it sounds like.
Right, right. So if you go to Danny Buys Houses, that's actually one of the templates. So
okay.
Yeah, no, fantastic. That's, and we do other marketing as well, you know, to supplement that. But yeah, that's where I get most of my leads.
Gotcha. Fantastic. So again, folks, flippingjunkie.com, reimobile.com, Danny's Buys Houses if you want to see what his site looks like. But if you like his site and want one of his templates, you can get him at leadpropeller.com. We'll put all of this on the show notes as well. Danny, thanks again for being on the show. This was fantastic.
Hey, thanks, Ken. I appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you soon. Take care. Hey, Deal Farm podcast listeners, this is Ken Corsini with a special offer. If you go to our website right now, dealfarm.net, you have the ability to download our new blueprint. It's called 30 Days to 10K. It's basically the exact blueprint you need to start profiting from wholesaling real estate right now. It's the resources, it's the websites, it's the services that we use. I've even included my exact postcard that I send out. Basically everything you need to start getting deals in the next 30 days. Again, it's at our website, dealfarm.net. Check it out, you can download it for free. Also, we still have our free t-shirt offer. If you want a free Deal Farm podcast t-shirt, just subscribe through iTunes to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating, and then go through our website, contact us, give us your name, address, and t-shirt size, and we will send you a t-shirt in the mail immediately. As always, thanks so much for listening to the Deal Farm. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.